Welcome to Conversations from the Pale Blue Dot. Today I interview philosopher Lydia McGrew.
There's a most unfortunate passage by G.K. Chesterton in which he says, if my apple woman, the woman who sells me apples, tells me that she saw a miracle, I should believe her. I believe her about apples, so I should believe her about miracles. It's a paraphrase. That's not an exact quotation. I really wish Chesterton had said that, because that's just wrong as an approach. You don't just automatically say, oh, somebody says he saw a miracle, I'm going to buy it. You have to have much stronger evidence than that.
If you like the show and want it to continue, do me a favor and write a kind review on iTunes or send the link to a friend. And now, my interview with Lydia McGrew. I can't introduce Dr. Lydia McGrew any better than she does on her website, where she writes, I am a homemaker and homeschooling mom, and I do analytic philosophy in some of my spare time. Lydia is the co-author of the final chapter of the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology called The Argument from Miracles, A Cumulative Case for the Resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, co-written with her husband Timothy McGrew. She is also the sole author of several papers in formal epistemology and other subjects, and a contributor to What's Wrong with the World, a group blog dedicated to the defense of what remains of Christendom. Lydia, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Luke.
Lydia, many philosophers and historians have argued that historians can't establish that a miracle occurred in history. And that's the view of David Hume and Ernst Troeltsch and F.H. Bradley. But you disagree with them. Could you summarize the arguments that are given by Hume and Troeltsch and Bradley about why historians can't establish the occurrence of a miracle, and then explain why you disagree with them?
Well, I can make a stab. This is a huge topic, of course, as you know. And there is a lot of similarity among the three that you've picked out. But I would distinguish them also in that Troeltsch and Bradley are making a claim about historians, qua historians, and sort of the definition of history. And Hume is making a point concerning testimony. So, of course, there's a lot that's been written about Hume, but to hit the Hume first briefly, his argument is that it's impossible to establish a religious miracle, specifically religious, by testimony. And, of course, there's a lot that can be said there about his essay on miracles. But one point I would stress is that in the second part of Hume's essay, he really evades the issue of historical testimony to the miraculous. He sort of set us all up in the first part, and, you know, would it be a greater miracle if the testimony were false than if a miracle had occurred? And then you expect him to go into this. And instead, he does what the 19th century writer Peter Bain calls a trial by proxy. And Christian apologists had never said, oh, you know, any miracle that's attested by testimony, we should just believe. Instead, they had particular miracles in mind, and especially the resurrection of Jesus. We're saying that there was especially strong evidence there, but Hume doesn't talk about that. Instead, he talks about the purported miracles at the station, the purported miracles at the tomb of the Abbey Paris, and that's really kind of an evasion. It's an attempt to imply that we should accept sweeping generalizations about the unreliability of testimony to miracles without getting into the nitty-gritty of the particulars in investigating the ones that are his true target, the specific central Christian miracles. This point is actually made by the non-Christian Christian author John Ehrman in his aptly titled book, Hume's Abject Failure. Now, Troeltsch and Bradley are working with the notion of an argument from analogy. So that's their whole deal about history, what history is. They say, well, historians have to argue by analogy. We can't know anything about what occurs in history unless it's got some analogy to our own experience. But a miracle would be disanalogous to all of our other experience, so a miracle cannot be established by history. That's sort of in a nutshell. Now, a lot of problems with this argument, but one of them is that principle of analogy really doesn't get us nearly as far as they think it does, because it really depends on where you go and what reference class you put an event in. I mean, in one sense, any historical event can be regarded as singular. Napoleon's being imprisoned, on the island of Elba, you know, we could say, well, no, that particular thing never happened before. Is this a violation of analogy? So a lot of times it depends on what level of description you take it at. Now, what this means is that we can look at a miracle or a purported miracle, and we can actually speak of it in terms as being analogous in some sense to something in our experience. This is a point made by Jay Houston in a book called Reported Miracles, A Critique of Hume. We can think of a miracle in terms of a person, God, communicating with other people, us, and using that miracle as a sign, an identifying marker, sort of like a password, to show that it really is God, that he's doing something that no one else could do. Now, that doesn't mean that miracles have happened, okay, but it means that both skeptics and Christians alike generally do recognize this notion of what is a miracle supposed to be? Well, it's supposed to be a sign from God. And we know what a sign from a person means. So that just means that this argument from analogy does not really work. It doesn't really show that there's something special about a miracle that makes it impossible for us to have historical evidence for a miracle.
Well, let's go back to Hume for just a moment, because I think one easy way for us to approach his concern about miracles is to ask a question like, well, okay, given our experience, is it more likely that a first century Jewish prophet rose from the dead, or is it more likely that a few people lied or exaggerated stories? And I think Hume would want to say, obviously, it's more likely that people lied or exaggerated stories, because that happens all the time, and it fits with our experience very well, whereas a miracle like rising from the dead is just not something we experience.
Sure. Well, and the first part of the essay, which, of course, was not the part I had talked about before, but the first part of the essay, what he says is, it would have to be, as he puts it, a greater miracle for the testimony to be false than for the actual miracle to occur. And, of course, that's just a way of speaking. And Ehrman models this as that, you know, it would have to be more improbable that the testimony would be false than that the miracle occurred. Now, you can, you know, you can cash that out probabilistically. And you can put it the way you just did. Well, hey, you know, we know of people lying all the time and so forth. The problem is that that's described at a very, very broad level, and that we're just saying people lying, okay? And, you know, the point I would emphasize is that that's lazy. When you're investigating something, you have to actually say, okay, but we're talking about the resources for lying here, in this type of case, in this situation. Was it likely that these people would lie under these circumstances, that they would be motivated to lie, and so forth? Now, Hume makes no pass at that. And in fact, he doesn't even mention the resurrection of Jesus. You probably know that. He sort of archly alludes to the possible resurrection of Queen Elizabeth. Instead, it's kind of amusing. And he mentions the transubstantiation of the Eucharist. I mean, he has this very sort of arch manner where he never even says what it is that he's talking about. But he certainly makes no attempt, none at all, to actually argue that the disciples, specifically of Jesus, were likely to have been lying, okay, or were likely to have been deceived. And how is that supposed to work? He doesn't even touch that. He doesn't get into that at all. And that's what Ehrman calls sort of standing up above and trying to hurl thunderbolts down from a sort of philosophical height rather than descending into the trenches and actually, you know, duking it out, as it were, over the actual historical evidence. And he doesn't even attempt to do that. So that's something that's been frustrating to apologists all along, actually.
So I'm not sure how getting more specific is going to help the case for the resurrection. I mean, if you want to get more specific about, say, people lying or telling exaggerated stories or deceiving themselves amidst a situation of religious fanaticism and the death of a charismatic leader of a small cult, I mean, that happens all the time as well. So when we get more specific in that way, it also seems extremely likely that there was falsehoods being told, and still extremely unlikely that somebody would actually come back from the dead.
Of course, the prior probability is very low, and we all know that. And one of the approaches of what I would call Humeans, sort of Hume's followers, is always to take us back to the prior and say, you know, come on, you know, miracles just never happen, you know, otherwise in our experience. And of course, no good Christian apologist is going to deny that the prior probability is low. In fact, if the prior probability weren't low, it wouldn't be very useful as a sign if it were something that happened every day. So you're definitely going to acknowledge that. But as far as specificity is concerned, first of all, I would definitely question the picture here of, quote, religious fanaticism. I think these guys, the picture we have of them is after the death of Jesus, they were just holed up, and they were just, you know, ready to keep a low profile and not involved in religious fanaticism. Moreover, there's the question of what was likely to happen to them if they started coming out and saying this. Resources for lying and probable consequences of preaching more were pretty bad, pretty negative. Really, they had no particular reason to do that. Lying is, in fact, what's interesting is that you'll find even among skeptical historians, the outright fraud hypothesis is just, it's not in favor. It hasn't been for a long time. People usually go more with some kind of mutual tale-telling or some form of vision or hallucination or something like that. The idea is that, as I believe it was Antonin Scalia put it, these guys engaged in a conspiracy to get themselves killed. It's very, very implausible. They stood to gain nothing. They really stood to lose a great deal. And that's why, of course, I think they really would have just lain low and really the whole thing would have just died away. They were, you know, they were terrified. Witnessing or even hearing about a crucifixion will do that to you. So actually, I think the specifics are very valuable because they have to do with the question of how likely are we to have the evidence that, in fact, we do have in the context in which it actually occurred if the event did not take place.
And I think I should say, Lydia, where I'm coming from is a generally skeptical view about the idea that we have much evidence at all about Jesus, certainly, and also his disciples. So for me, it's hard to get on board with a program that so specifically speculates about the nature of, say, the death of Jesus, or the, you know, the psychology of the disciples, or how, I mean, all of that stuff, I think, is just extremely speculative from my point of view, anyway. And so I'm not sure how much we could be serious about presenting reasons why, you know, we understand the situation well enough that we can say that it would be very unlikely for them to exaggerate stories or hallucinate, as in the case of so many other religious cults.
Well, you know, the origin of Christianity, of course, is a historical phenomenon. I mean, you know, you didn't have it, and then you had it. You know, that much, I think, you know, anyone would agree. Certainly, if you're going to throw the texts out wholesale, all right, you're going to be left without much evidence. I mean, that kind of goes without saying. I'm not prepared here and now to launch into a defense of the general authenticity of those texts. But what I would emphasize is that authenticity or origin does not presuppose that everything that is said there is true, but does indicate, and I would say that I believe we do have sufficient evidence to locate these as first century texts, and as being written by people who were close to the situation and therefore is reflecting what was said, what was claimed, what the disciples in fact did. Okay, now that you can then say, well, you know, they might have just been making it all up. But at that point, we are getting into hypothesizing how did that come about that they were out there preaching this message. And I do think we have a pretty good reason to take these to be an authentic indication of what their testimony was, of the content of that testimony, and of, you know, when they began saying it and what it was that they began saying. And that evidence is, in a sense, a datum or a set of data that we need to find an explanation for.
So, Lydia, you talked about how, yes, the prior probability of somebody rising from the dead is very, very low. So how is it in your article for the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology that you go about developing an argument to you know, start with that prior probability being very low to end up saying that we have good reason to believe that the resurrection did occur?
Okay, yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think we do have to have very strong evidence. Something you're probably going to find me repeating over and over again, so I hope that doesn't get boring, but is that no one has to say or should say that you just automatically believe anything that anyone testifies to. That we just say, oh, yes, testimony, well, I'll buy that. There's a most unfortunate passage by G.K. Chesterton in which he says, if my apple woman, the woman who sells me apples, tells me that she saw a miracle, I should believe her. I believe her about apples, so I should believe her about miracles. It's a paraphrase. That's not an exact quotation. I really wish Chesterton hadn't said that, because that's just wrong as an approach. You don't just automatically say, oh, somebody says he saw a miracle, I'm going to buy it. You have to have much stronger evidence than that. So in Bayesian terms, what we do in the article is that we try to separate what we would call the indirect, what one might call, I should say, the indirect evidence, which would be relevant to that prior probability, from the direct evidence. So the things that would be relevant to the prior probability would be things like evidence for and against theism, for example. Evidence for and against the existence specifically of the God of Israel, the God of the Jews, or other evidence prior to Jesus' purported resurrection regarding who Jesus was and so forth. That would all be relevant to the prior. And what we focus on in the article instead is what we might call the direct evidence, the evidence that supposedly tells you what happened, what you might call reports or that kind of thing. You might call it evidence after the fact. So when we focus on the testimony of the disciples and of certain women that said that they saw and spoke with Jesus, the evidence of the disciples' willingness to die for that testimony, and the evidence of the conversion of the Apostle Paul. And what we try to do is we use a modeling device known as a Bayes factor. Roughly speaking, a Bayes factor tries to model, number one, which way the evidence is pointing, and number two, how strongly the evidence is pointing that way. And what you're trying to do at that point is you're trying to look at explanatory resources of the hypothesis, in this case the resurrection, and the negation of the hypothesis. How well does each of these explain the evidence, and is there a big difference between how well each of these explains the evidence? I should clarify that when I say difference, too, it's actually a ratio. You measure it, very important that you measure it by the ratio, not by the difference. But you need to look at those two hypotheses and see which one gives you a better expectation of that evidence and how much better is that expectation. So we estimate Bayes factors for these various separate pieces of evidence. Then we argue for the legitimacy of multiplying these Bayes factors, because that gives you a lot of kick, and you have to discuss that issue, and we do, of independence and whether it's legitimate to multiply them in order to combine those Bayes factors. And that ends up with this very high combined Bayes factor in our estimate as we go over that evidence. And so what we estimate is that you could have this overwhelmingly low prior probability, and I don't actually think the prior probability is this low. I think it's low, but I don't think it's this low, of 10 to the negative 40th, and still give a probability to the resurrection in excess of 0.9999. And we don't get to that by saying, in fact, the evidence gives us a posterior probability in excess of 0.9999. We just say, well, this is the power of the Bayes factor and of the combined Bayes factor, and a combined power that great could overcome this great of a prior improbability and would give you this high of a posterior probability. So that's the basic method.
Yeah, and then there are a number of questions that would follow from that. The first one is, what if we applied those same methods to, say, other claims for which it seems to me anyway that we have far greater evidence than for the resurrection of Jesus, just based on proximity to the events? For example, we have lots of written testimony about witchcraft being practiced in Salem, or much more recently, the so-called Hindu milk miracle of 1995, where we have, you know, living witnesses by the dozens, contemporary original documents, video documentation. You know, the evidence is much better for these types of miracles, and yet I don't think we take them very seriously, despite having better evidence for them than for an event that supposedly occurred 2,000 years ago.
Sure. Well, you know, as you can probably imagine, of course, I'm not going to agree that we have far better evidence in those cases. And one thing we need to realize is that it's not ever just a matter of nose counting. I mean, you never just say, oh, we have N witnesses here and we have N times 10 witnesses over here, so this must be better. Instead, we have to be always comparing explanations, looking at those explanatory resources. How well can we explain the evidence given the supernatural explanation, and how well can we explain it given no supernatural occurrence? Now, in the Salem case, the so-called evidence was not even publicly available in principle. And this was actually controversial even at the time. People objected on this basis. It was what was called spectral evidence. And the supposed victims said that they saw the specters of the accused people afflicting them, which cannot be independently checked. There's a writer in the deist controversy named Charles Leslie. In fact, right around the same time, late 17th century, he wrote A Short and Easy Method with the Deists. And one of the things he pointed out was that the first criterion for detecting a miracle is that it has to be the sort of thing of which men's outward senses can be the judge. So, for example, if someone is dead and other people are out there saying that he's alive, you can go check. You can go see if the body is there. But there was no way of checking these claims in the Salem witch trials. They could say whatever they liked. These were supposedly wholly private visions of the specter, and they suffered no repercussions. Nobody got in trouble. Nobody was turned around and, you know, burned or hung or whatever for having given this evidence. So the possibility of outright lying has to be extremely high because there was no particular motive not to. There was no penalty. And we also are sometimes dealing with children who had the suggestion of witchcraft made to them by authority figures. In one case, a child, I don't have the name here, but was sick, and a doctor came, and the doctor suggested to the family, for all we know, in the hearing of the child, that this might be caused by witchcraft. So we have vast resources, it seems to me, here for your purely natural explanation, which is means that there's not going to be traction for that base factor. To put this in colloquial terms, if natural explanations can do a good job of explaining the evidence that we have, then we're not going to be justified in reaching for a supernatural explanation. And I really believe that's true in the Salem case. Now, in the case of the Hindu milk miracle, I looked this up and did a little research on it, and I was actually able to some extent, recreate this in my own kitchen. I used water because it's not as messy as milk, but I have a piece of tile with an unglazed back, and I got a little spoonful of water, which is what they were offering to the gods, the idols, and they were offering a spoon, so I had a spoon, and I dipped the corners of the tile into the water, and I was actually able to soak up water from that spoon, although it took a while because a square tile is not a very good shape. An elephant trunk would be a better shape. Now, this milk miracle involved a vast number of different people, and one thing I want to emphasize is that when you say, oh, there were so many people, but they weren't all attesting, of course, to the very same events. They were attesting to different tokens of what was allegedly the same type of event. Mm-hmm. So you could have different explanations in different cases. I mean, some people easily could just be lying. I mean, nobody was there checking every single event. But it does appear that in at least one case, some investigators used food coloring and verified that something like what happened in my kitchen was happening, that the statue was soaking the milk up naturally. It was getting all over the underside of the statue. And of course, another possibility in some cases could just be fooling yourself. You stick something into a little spoon, and it's easy to say, well, you know, maybe that went down, that level went down. There could have been a variety of non-supernatural things going on here, but I would say that capillary action probably is what kicked off that hysteria, and probably happened in more than one case. So again, we have to look at the power of different types of explanations. We have to compare that explanatory power, and many purported miracles won't stand up to that type of an investigation.
Well, that's fascinating, the way that you've clarified the different ways that we might have evidence for these events. So it sounds like you're saying that there are some natural explanations that are available for accounting for things like Salem witch testimony and also the Hindu milk miracle that may not be available when trying to explain the data surrounding the resurrection of Jesus, but also that in lots of other ways the types of evidence for in each case are quite different and have to be handled quite differently.
Absolutely, always. In fact, there's a paper that Tim and I are working on right now concerning witness reliability. And there used to be a kind of crude way of approaching this where you would say, imagine a witness who speaks the truth 9 times out of 10 or whatever. You sort of give this witness a reliability number. And then you'd say, and suppose we have 3 of these or how many ever, you know, and they are independent. How many of these witnesses is it going to take to overcome this prior improbability? Now, that's just an interesting and neat mathematical way to approach it. And as a mathematical approach, I don't object to it. But as an approach to actual historical evidence, it just won't do, because you don't go at it that way. When you're figuring a Bayes factor, you shouldn't just say, well, let's assign a reliability number to this witness, and then that's going to kind of be the way I do my Bayes factor. Instead, you look at all sorts of surrounding circumstances in which the witness gives his testimony, and that's how you decide how much that evidence favors, or even whether that evidence favors, the event to which he's testifying. And it's going to be vastly different in every different case.
Now, in his book, Warranted Christian Belief, Alvin Plantinga expressed a particular concern about this way of arguing for the resurrection or similar miracles, and he called it the problem of dwindling probabilities. I wonder, could you explain what was Plantinga's concern, and how would you respond to it?
Okay, well, and it's very hard, I have to admit, even as a philosopher, for me to explain sympathetically, because in my opinion, his worry is based on a rather fundamental error in probability theory, and actually, he has to some extent retrenched. I think he kind of goes back and forth a little bit here since the exchange that we had in Philosophy of Christi. But stated very briefly, his worry is that we have to, he believes, treat the existence of God as a premise for the conclusion that Christianity is true, and that, for example, Jesus rose from the dead, and that if we do this, if we treat the existence of God as the premise, then even if we estimate, to begin with, a relatively high probability for the existence of God, he gives 0.9, for example, in Warranted Christian Belief as his generous estimate, then it's all downhill from there. That's the way I like to explain it. And the highest probability we'll be able to support for the much richer claims of Christianity, as the argument goes on, is going to be something way lower than that. And he gives a complex reason for this because of the need to multiply probabilities in a chain, what I would call a concatenated argument, a chain argument. Now, I think it's important to be very precise here. Sometimes people, including philosophers, will use the phrase principle of dwindling probabilities for any sort of low estimate of the historical evidence for Christianity or for anything that has sort of something to do with multiplying. And Plantinga has got a very specific strategy, a very specific concern, where you start with that estimated probability for theism, and then you go downward from there in estimating your probability for these richer claims. And in essence, the way he gets into this confusion, as I would call it, is to treat a probability for theism as a single probability, a fixed point, without distinguishing between the probability for theism as it should be without the detailed evidence for a miracle, like the resurrection, for example, and a probability with that evidence, or after taking that evidence into account. That's just not right. I mean, because the probability of theism is going to be different, or it should be different, before and after you take new evidence into account. That should change. It shouldn't remain the same before and after, and especially as I believe this evidence is itself fairly strong, you shouldn't just keep that evidence, that probability of theism, the same. So sometimes he'll say something like, suppose somebody is an agnostic, and Plantinga, he even still said this in the Philosophy of Christi exchange. Suppose somebody is an agnostic. Well, then his probability for theism is, you know, at most 0.5, and then boom, we're off to the races. Well, of course, someone might be an agnostic before he looks at the evidence, but maybe he shouldn't be an agnostic after he looks at the evidence. From a Bayesian perspective, we always have to be updating our probabilities on the basis of whatever new evidence we've taken into account. And you know, I remember when I first read that passage in More to Christian Belief, and someone, you know, drew it to my attention, what's going on here? And I opened it, and I looked through, and I looked through page after page, and I turned to him, and I said, where's Bayes' theorem? I don't see Bayes' theorem anywhere. And the problem is that Planning is continually working with the theorem on total probability. He's never working with Bayes' theorem. And that is really, it's a huge problem because he never has a chance to update that probability of theism. And that is how I think he gets into this, because he's not really doing a cumulative case argument where we update at different steps. And there really is no such thing as a principle of dwindling probabilities for a cumulative case argument.
Well, and I think the intuition maybe behind his worry is something like this. If you're starting with, you know, let's just be generous and say the probability of theism is 0.9, and then, but in order to establish the resurrection, you're pulling on these other factors, like, let's say that Jesus existed and was crucified by the Romans. Let's say the probability of that is 0.9. You've got, let's say the probability, the reports about him actually appearing to certain people, maybe the probability of those is like 0.7 or something. And if you get a bunch of these and you multiply and you consider the possibility of them all being true, all of these things, then you multiply the probabilities and you end up with something lower than 0.5. Is that maybe the intuition that's going on here?
In very rough terms, although he doesn't use those particular ones, he uses God would want to make a revelation of himself and things like that. But the problem is that you should not keep the probability of what you started with it at. And here we need to think a little bit about Richard Swinburne, whom Plantinga claims to be actually using as sort of his model of the best presentation of the case for sort of an evidentialist historical approach. Uh-huh. And, you know, Swinburne argues for theism first, but Swinburne's very clear. He says, if you have good reason to believe that God exists, given, he says, other evidence. Swinburne's very clear, other evidence. Now, what Swinburne means there are things like, you know, cosmological argument, arguments from natural theology, and the kind of arguments that, you know, Swinburne gives before he gets to the resurrection of the Son of God. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that might give you whatever it is, you know, your 0.9 or whatever, but that is going to then change after. You're not going to just multiply. That's completely incorrect. Let me give you a sort of rough and ready example. Suppose that a girl is wondering whether she's going to have a date with a certain man next week, and she says, well, and the only place she has to meet this man is at a party. So she says, well, it's very, very probable I'm going to go to this party. And if I go to this party, I have a new dress, and it's probable that this guy is going to notice me. And if he notices me, it's probable he's going to talk to me. And if he talks to me, I'm just so charming that it's probable that he's going to ask me out for a date. So then she thinks, probably I'm going to have a date next week. Now, if we assume that there are no other resources for this young woman to have a date with this man next week, then that's what I would call a chain argument. All we have to have all these things, right? And she's not bringing in any more evidence about this date or anything. She's reasoning, as you might say, before the fact. She's trying before the fact to guess, will she have a date with this man next week? And that would be sort of this chain thing where you multiply down, and by the time you're done, it's not nearly as good as she might think it is if she really stopped to think about it. On the other hand, what I would be advocating instead would be something more analogous to her waking up one morning and looking at her calendar and seeing that she has written down, you know, I have a date with John this evening, okay? Now, in that case, whatever her probability was going into the party for, you know, John's noticing her or talking to her or whatever, that's like all old news at this point. At this point, she has direct evidence that John has asked her to the party. So in the same way, the 0.9 probability that Plantinga estimates for the existence of God, which he calls generous, and I suppose if we're just considering the arguments for natural theology, it probably is kind of generous. That's old news by the time we get to evidence directly that Jesus rose from the dead. There, we should be updating. And if we had a 0.9 probability for the existence of God before, then I would say, after we take this evidence into account, then you should have something much higher than a 0.9 probability for God after, because obviously if Jesus rose from the dead, the probability that God exists is a lot higher than if we have no evidence that Jesus rose from the dead.
Wait, but how does this work? Because we're relying on the assumption that God exists in order to make it probable that Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, it's extremely improbable that Jesus rose from the dead if God does not exist, right?
Right. I think the problem here, and I think it's interesting that you should put it this way, we had an email exchange with Alvin Plantinga, and I think it was before the Philosophy of Christi exchange, and I wasn't writing the email, Tim was, and I suggested to him, I said, put in this email, ask him whether he thinks this would be circular otherwise, whether he thinks that this would conflict with his and our foundationalist model of epistemology, if we used God's existence in some sense as a premise for the resurrection, and then the evidence for the resurrection is a premise supporting the existence of God. And Tim asked him that question. He said, no, I don't think that's what's bothering me. But actually, in a sense, I think it is, because I think we're dealing with what we might call a deductive model. And that is not going to do when we're dealing with non-deductive inference. Tim and I have an article in Erkenntness, which has no mention of anything in the philosophy of religion whatsoever. It's about mutual support and foundationalism. And I just love this article. I'm just so proud of this article. I'm so fond of this article. It took a lot of work. But what it does is to show how you can model within a foundationalist system of epistemology support going in two different directions. And so, no, we don't have to begin with, first of all, we don't have to assume that God exists to believe that the resurrection occurred. Certainly, our evidence regarding the existence of God will influence the prior probability of the resurrection. I mean, that kind of goes without saying, right? If you've got some evidence for the existence of God, that's relevant to the resurrection. If you believe because of the problem of evil, you have evidence against the existence of God, that's relevant to the resurrection. All this stuff is relevant. But no, you don't have to definitely believe God exists and then argue in some sense deductively to the resurrection from this. Instead, you've simply got evidence that, as we put it in the Blackwell article on Plantinga, borrowing from that Erkenntness article, is channeled to the resurrection by the proposition that God exists. But then, on the other hand, you have evidence that is channeled by the resurrection, the proposition that the resurrection occurred, to the proposition that God exists. So in a sense, you've got what we call lines of evidence going in both directions. So there's no circularity actually going on. It's just that you have evidence that affects one of them by means of the other in each direction.
Now, Lydia, in the article that you wrote with Tim for the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, you took a Bayesian approach to establishing the resurrection of Jesus. There are many others who would take what you might call an explanationist account, where it's more modeled after an inference to the best explanation, where you look for the explanation of the facts that has the greatest number and degree of explanatory virtues, like explanatory scope, explanatory power, all those kinds of things. Are the two mutually compatible? Do you think that the other approach is wrongheaded, or what are your thoughts on that?
I would call what we are doing a Bayesian model of an inference to the best explanation. I like to call what we're doing an inference to the best explanation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely modeled in probabilistic terms. One of the problems with explanationism, you know, with that ism on the end, is that there's a kind of a territorial desire to make IBE independent of probabilities, to make it, no, you know, you can't just explain this in probabilistic terms. This has its sort of irreducible nature to it. And I think that is a mistake. I think explanationism in that strong sense is a mistake. But I think I love inference to the best explanation. It's just that I think being a good Bayesian is really, in a sense, being the best kind of explanationist.
Right. Okay. And then we've been talking about the resurrection, and it's been fascinating so far. But I wonder if we take a step back and just talk about Christian philosophy in general, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, because there are some Christian philosophers like Alvin Plantinga or William Lane Craig who define themselves as Christians first and philosophers second, and make no apologies about it. They make no apologies that they start from Christian assumptions and are doing philosophy from there. But then, you know, there are other philosophers who want to say, well, no, I'm a philosopher who assesses the evidence and the reasons first, and then I come to Christianity by way of that. What is your view on all of that?
Okay. That's a fascinating and great set of questions. And I want to say at the outset, in fairness, that both William Lane Craig and Alvin Plantinga have argued for theism, and in the case of Craig, for Christianity specifically, from evidence. I mean, Plantinga has that, what is it, 24 ways, arguments for the existence of God. And of course, Dr. Craig is a very strong proponent of historical apologetics and knows a great deal about it. So I don't want to seem to be going along with any characterization of them. You know, you could almost say they, you know, they don't practice what they preach or whatever, but they really do give evidence. They really do give arguments. Although Plantinga, unfortunately, has attacked specifically the historical argument, but he does argue for theism. As far as the question of the right way to do it, in part that's a philosophical question and in part that's a practical question. I'm a staunch evidentialist. I do believe that Christianity is rationally defensible. I believe that Christians ought to be able, within their capacities, to defend their faith. That doesn't mean from a practical perspective that I would hold some kind of caricatured view according to which, for example, Christian parents should never teach their children anything about God until they're at least 15 years old and they can, you know, evaluate the evidence for themselves. I mean, after all, parents teach their children about atoms and planets and all kinds of scientific things when they're younger on the basis of just answering their questions. The kid says, you know, Mom, why is this guy blue? And you give the scientific answer. You expect the child to accept your credibility. You have good reason for it, and therefore you believe you're not deceiving the child. So I think that's completely legitimate with Christianity as well. Now, as far as starting with the evidence and seeing if it leads to Christianity, you know, of course, chronologically, I was a Christian before I was a philosopher, but there came a time when I questioned that, and I think when that comes, and I think that's going to come for anybody, you ought to have evidence, and I don't think that falling back on something like this is just properly basic, as in that's Plantinga's system, I don't think that's correct. I disagree with him that the existence of God or the truth of Christianity is properly basic. And I think that it's because of that notion that Plantinga thinks that we can, as you put it, you know, start with Christian assumptions. And so in a sense, I don't believe that. But to say, well, I'm a philosopher first and a, you know, Christian second, I don't look at it that way. I'm a philosopher and a Christian, and I view this as all fitting together extremely well from an evidential perspective. Now, I do agree with one thing that Plantinga says in his paper on Advice to Christian Philosophers, which I know is the one that you are particularly alluding to here, when he says that we should be tough-minded and we shouldn't always be out there assuming that other positions, naturalism or whatever, are based on arguments or some kind of new discovery when they're really just a trend of the times. He's very amusing about this with positivism and the criterion for meaning, and he does it extremely well. And he talks about being rational and believing in Christianity in that article. And of course, I know that he's packing all of his proper basicality into that, but I can take that in my own sense, and I can say and agree with this form of words, even if I don't mean quite the same thing he does, if we are rational in believing that Christianity is true, which as an evidentialist I think we can be, then of course we have reasons to believe that positions that contradict Christianity are false. I mean, that just sort of follows. And as a good Bayesian, of course, I'm going to advocate making sure that your probability distribution is consistent. So, of course, I'm going to say that your reasons for Christianity are ipso facto reasons against physicalism, for example. But I also think that Plantinga doesn't, in that paper, give sufficient weight or talk enough about or acknowledge that many of these positions that he mentions, for example, physicalism, as one he discusses, can be seen to be false philosophically, as well as by way of an indirect argument where we'd say, well, I have reason, you know, because of the resurrection or whatever, to believe that God exists, therefore I have reason to believe physicalism is false. And that you can go that way, but in some ways that's a detour. In some ways that's an indirect route. And he doesn't seem to want to talk about the fact that there can be a much more direct way of discussing these from a purely philosophical point of view. And so some of his rhetoric in that paper particularly gives the impression that he advocates a kind of in-house Christian philosophy. And he even says, I really cringed over this, something about we should be dealing with the problems, we should be philosophers for the Christian community and dealing with the problems that concern the Christian community. And that was just a real head-scratcher for me, because maybe I'm just too much of an individualist, but I don't regard myself as dealing with the problems for any community. I'm dealing with the problems that interest me. And he sort of gives the sort of hothouse impression that Christian philosophers should just go off into their little corner and do Christian philosophy. And I think that would not be a good idea, and I don't think Christians should do that.
Well, you spoke about your disagreements with Alvin Plantinga's position that his Christianity is properly basic, and it's hard to even, you know, have a dialogue with somebody like that, because there is no evidence that would be interesting to him, I don't think. But then there's also somebody like William Lane Craig, who says that, quotes Luther, Martin Luther, in saying that the only proper use of reason is to clarify and defend Christianity, and reason can't stand above Christianity and demonstrate anything about its falsehood or potential weaknesses or anything like that. And that, too, is also just kind of conversation-stopping. And I'm always heartened to find somebody like yourself who is an evidentialist, and because we can actually have a dialogue. Unfortunately, you know, it'll be 20 years before I can interact with your Bayesian analysis of the resurrection or something like that. But, you know, we're at least talking, and we supposedly are both responsive to evidence and things like that. Mm-hmm. From your perspective, what does that sound like?
You know, it just sounds so odd coming from someone so incredibly learned as Dr. Craig, who knows so well the historical evidence. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he knows. I mean, there are more things that he doesn't maybe talk about concerning, for example, the authenticity of the text. He kind of sticks to this minimal facts approach, which I think is a little too restricted, but he is really very learned, and he has always, in one sense, I've always thought of him as an evidentialist. And then this other stuff just sort of comes out of nowhere, and I don't understand why he says that, and I don't know why he wants to say that. Now, my impression, and I should check this out, but my impression is that he's not always said the same thing, that in some places he has said that, for example, if he could be convinced that, you know, Jesus' body had really been found or something, you know, he would abandon Christianity. So I'm not sure he always says the very same thing about this, but I would never say anything like what Luther says. I think it's very confusing. It's very misleading. I mostly have Calvinist friends who say stuff like that to me, and they'll quote, you know, Calvin along similar lines. And my response is always that you have to start from where you are, and that you cannot literally leap outside of your own head and say, okay, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go check separately from evidence and see if this is true. And then I'll compare it, you know, to my evidence or something like that. Evidence isn't a way of finding out if this is true. That is our only route. We don't have some kind of direct insight to the existence of God or the truth of Christianity. I think there are things that we can know directly. Don't get me wrong. I believe in a priori knowledge of mathematics, for example, or of my own existence, for example. But I don't believe that there is some way to have a direct foundational apprehension of the truth of Christianity. So this seems to me always like a misguided way to talk about it, to say, well, I'm putting my reason above God. What I want to say is, well, no, in a sense, you're not, because you don't worship your reason. If you're a Christian, you worship God. You don't worship your reason. But as far as your route to know about God, there is no other way. There is no other route. And so why pretend that you have some other special access to it? And, you know, I don't want to close down the possibility of mystical experience or something that someone else might have had that I haven't had. But speaking for myself, I have no other route to know whether God exists.
Well, and you would probably, in mystical experiences, just count that as a type of evidence that is a certain...
I would. I would talk about how would I explain this. I mean, I had someone bring up some near-death experience that, you know, someone had recounted, and I said right away, are there tie-downs to... It was something about, you know, that he knew details of the surgery, the operating room, or something like that. I said, well, did he check? Were those correct? Are you looking for tie-downs to something external to my own mind or external to my own head to say, wow, you know, then I might be impressed. You know what I'm saying? If I'm just making this up, if I heard a voice in my head that said, you know, go check on old Mrs. So-and-so, your neighbor, because she's having a problem. And I actually went over there and I opened the door and I called her and she said, oh, I'm so glad you came. I was just praying. I fell down and I couldn't get... Now that would be really an interesting kind of mystical experience, because there it would be one kind of evidence. I would check on it, and then the evidence would be that coincidence between what the voice in my head had said and what I found when I went to the house. So you're right, that would be just another kind of evidence.
Now, finally, one more topic to ask you about. You've also done some work on the fine-tuning argument for the existence of God, and one of the papers that you wrote offers what you call a skeptical view about the probabilities involved in the fine-tuning argument. I think most of my listeners are going to be pretty familiar with the basics of the fine-tuning argument, but where does your concern come in?
Okay, well, yeah, to give a short version, we think there's a technical problem with that probability of a life-permitting universe given no design. So, you know, most of these approaches are Bayesian, so they're comparing the probability given design and given no design. And in that paper in mind that you're mentioning, we discussed the probability given no design. And it has to do with the fact that when you're dealing with constants, with numbers, there are an infinite number of possibilities that these numbers could take, and there is no non-arbitrary way to do what we call putting down a function over them. And, you know, if you think about this, a bell curve is a function, or any kind of a curve like that, that's a function. Well, there's no way to do that. And usually what people try to do is they try to put a flat function down over them. It gives equal probability to all this infinite number of possibilities. Right away, you have a problem with standard probability theory, with the Kolmogorov axioms. You can't do that. It's like an infinite lottery where you're trying to give every one of an infinite number of tickets an equal probability of winning the lottery. And you're not going to be able to make them all, as we might put it, add up to one, which is what probabilities are usually supposed to do. Now, advocates of the fine-tuning argument have offered various attempted ways around this, but they've run into other problems. One way to do it is to throw out some of the axioms. That's pretty radical. And by doing that, then they say, now we're going to be allowed to have equal probabilities for all of an infinite number of possibilities. Now, what's interesting there is that it's easy enough to just say, oh, well, they threw out some of the axioms of probability. So what? What are the consequences of that? From, you know, every man philosopher's point of view, that doesn't necessarily sound like a huge problem. Well, an intuitive problem there is that that attempted fix then makes the fine-tuning argument, as traditionally presented, no stronger than what we call a coarse-tuning argument. Now, as you know, the fine-tuning argument is traditionally presented, focuses on this extremely narrow range and says these constants have to fall in this extremely narrow range. If they don't fall into this extremely narrow range, no life-permitting universe. It just can't happen. It'll be all black holes or whatnot. Okay. Well, the coarse-tuning argument would say, if the constants didn't fall into this gigantic range, you know, it's not narrow at all. It's absolutely gigantic, but it is finite. Okay, it's a finite range. They have to fall somewhere within this finite range, but it's a huge, you know, many, many orders of magnitude larger than what we believe, in fact, is the range in which they have to fall. That argument would be just as strong as the fine-tuning argument,
right,
as traditionally.
Because the possible range of the values is infinite.
It's infinite. That's right, to which you are comparing it. That's right.
Yeah.
Now, any finite range is going to be just as strong of an argument for design.
Yeah.
Now, something's got to be wrong there. And the thing is, I kind of like the fine-tuning argument. I feel a little bad that I'm sort of known as this person who wrote this article, you know, attacking the fine-tuning argument. So I have this intuitive sympathy for it, but my intuitive sympathy is also the original fine-tuning argument. I have no sympathy for an argument that's going to make that equivalent to a coarse-tuning argument. If there is some solution to this problem that we raise, that can't be it. Any solution that is going to make the fine-tuning argument no stronger than a coarse-tuning argument has got to be wrong.
Well, have there been any solutions that sound a bit more promising so far?
I thought of one the other day, but Tim shot it down. you know, I do try to do this because I like the argument. I thought to myself, well, suppose we were to try to give meaning to this notion of a probability on no design for the universe to have these features. Suppose we argued that in order to give meaning to this, there actually has to be some physical process that generates universes. And you'll sometimes see, you know, you see presentations of this, they'll actually draw a funny looking sort of machine, you know, universe generating mechanism or something. And not that it would actually have to be a machine, but that it would be some sort of physical process, and maybe with like a collapsing and expanding series of universes or something, and there'd have to be this process. And that then what I tried to argue was, then because it would be a physical process, it would have limits. There
right.
would be only a finite number of possibilities that this physical process could generate. Therefore, we actually don't have to compare it to an infinite range. And so I presented that to him, and he pointed out, though, that from our perspective epistemically, we don't know which physical process is. So therefore, we're going to be bringing that infinite number of possibilities back in again in terms of epistemic probability, because then there's going to be an infinite number of different mechanisms or machines that could be, machine being just a term here, but that could be generating universes. And so we still are stuck with that infinite number of possibilities that we can't put a function down over. So much for that one. But no, I haven't otherwise.
Well, what if we somehow, I'm not sure how, but what if we somehow discovered and had high certainty about a physical process that produced our universe and produces other universes as well, and so we knew what the real limits of the values were? Would that help?
I don't know how we could possibly know that. I think it might. Of course, one question would be, if that were a non-personal process, then the question would be, does that sort of, in a sense, remove the force of the argument by saying, oh, well, we know where it came from. It came from this non-personal process. So, you know, we're not going to argue the existence of God. But I suppose one could at that point say, but that itself had to, you know, have a cause or something like that, and try to make some sort of, seek some sort of explanation for that process. So, yeah, I think potentially that could help. But part of the problem is, of course, that universes are usually understood in terms of causal isolation from one another.
Yeah.
So if we cannot, because of this causal isolation, know even about the characteristics of other universes than ours, how, a fortiori, could we know the characteristics of a mechanism that generated, you know, ours or a group of them? I just don't know how that would even be. Which is unfortunate, in my opinion. I once met an atheist who did not know that I criticized the fine-tuning argument, and who said, and I think at the moment he thought that I was a fellow atheist, and said, you know, that's the best one they've got. That fine-tuning argument, that's the best one they've got. And I just felt awful, you know, as a Christian. And I think the conversation got, you know, interrupted or something, and we didn't get into discussing it further. But, you know, I would love to see that argument fly. So I'm still waiting. I'm still listening for further suggestions.
Well, and of course, that's Dawkins' view. I mean, he of any of the arguments, he would say that the fine-tuning argument is the most interesting to him. But I'm quite certain he's not aware of your paper.
that could well be. And, you know, I don't want to psychologize too much, but I would say sometimes that I think some people like the fine-tuning argument because they don't like miracles. And the fine-tuning argument seems sort of safely non-miraculous because it's almost, you know, that God is just setting it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that
yeah.
doesn't tell us anything about his actually intervening. And intervention is sort of almost a, you know, that's where the problem's supposed to come in.
Yeah.
So.
Now, Lydia, one of my major interests in the philosophy of religion is this issue of theism and explanation. And Gregory Dawes recently wrote a book that is very useful in this field. And he points out that there seem to be a lot of problems when talking about a good explanation that is a supernatural explanation. Now, he's coming at it from an explanationist point of view. You're coming at it from a Bayesian point of view. But they're still both methods of inference to the best explanation. And it's hard for me to grapple with the idea of offering a best explanation that, for example, is something that is defined to be the opposite of everything we understand. God is supposed to be a person, but without a body. He thinks without a brain. He acts, but not in space. He draws plans, but not in time. All these kinds of paradoxes. Mm-hmm. How could that ever... I mean, that seems like the most radically, extremely ad hoc hypothesis that could even ever be concocted. How could that ever be the best explanation for something? I mean, even, like, especially if we're looking at, like, say, the design argument, even mm-hmm. aliens that are the product of evolution on another planet and snuck here without our knowledge and, you know, made mm-hmm. some bizarre complex structure, even that seems to be a less ad hoc, more plausible explanation for, say, you know, some specific design. How is it that a supernatural being defined as the opposite of everything we do understand could be the best explanation for something, like the resurrection of Jesus?
Sure. Well, now, as you know, of course, Dawes does say that it is in principle possible that theism could be the best explanation. Now, he's very, very skeptical about whether it ever actually will be, but he actually does argue that it could be. Also, I'm gonna get myself in trouble with my Thomist friends here, but I think it is important that we not think in terms of this extreme negative theology. God is, you know, unknowably different from anything that we could ever imagine or something like that. I think that's a mistake, and I don't see why we should start with that concept of God. And I think, in fact, if we do start with the concept of God as literally being unknowably different from anything we could ever imagine, then it is going to be impossible for him to communicate with us. And I don't think theists should saddle themselves with that concept of God. And I think it will be sort of a joy to skeptics and our opponents if we do say that we're saddling ourselves with that. To me, to say that God is a person is itself quite informative. I mean, I don't think of that as being part of the problem. I think of that as being part of the solution, in a sense. As far as his being disembodied, I suppose I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that I'm a Cartesian dualist, so that doesn't bother me at all. to imagine thinking without a body, I can imagine thinking without a body, you know, much, much less God. So, and Hockness, of course, is a different kind of issue. It's an epistemic issue in which I just have an enormous amount of interest. I'm actually working right now on an article concerning the existence of the external world and different scenarios and the issue of ad hocness. Ad hocness is always in relation to evidence, and it's always understood in terms of adding auxiliary hypotheses to avoid the, Popper would say, falsification. I would say disconfirmation of an hypothesis. I certainly don't think that the qualities that are traditionally attributed to God are attributed to him in a sense to avoid falsification. I mean, that isn't the point. It's not like we started out by believing in God as a little green man, and then we changed it and said, oh no, whoops, he's disembodied because we didn't see a little green man or something like that. So I don't see those as ad hoc. It is certainly an unusual hypothesis, and I'm not going to say that, you know, we should start out with some kind of high probability for the existence of God. And here I think I would depart from Swinburne. I would not say that there's some kind of absolute prior probability for the existence of God, prior to all evidence, which is not too bad because it's simple or something like that. And I'm not going to buy that. It's an existence claim. And like any other specific existence claim, I mean, any specific existence claim that a certain planet exists, doesn't, isn't going to have a very high prior probability. And I don't know how to model that. I think the issue of priors, what you might call absolute priors, prior to all evidence, is extremely difficult, and probably we should not be claiming that we have them.
Yeah.
But you know, like, yeah, no evidence, but I have a prior. I don't even know what that means. But certainly any specific existence claim, and the stronger it is, the more evidence you require. And I would definitely accept that burden of proof with respect to the existence of God. But as far as how it could be an explanation, I would say in something like the same way that my existence and my action can be an explanation of events in the world. And I know that sounds like a pretty strong analogy between God and man, but I actually think that we're entitled to hypothesize and then test the hypothesis of a God who bears a sufficient similarity to man that we can detect his presence and we can detect his action. Now, we may go out there then and say, well, no, I guess such a God doesn't exist because we don't find that evidence. But I think that's a hypothesis, and that we can take that as a hypothesis and test it. And so that's why I think we need miracles. I really do. And to go out there and say, okay, this looks like a better explanation, that this deity did this. But that requires an enormous amount of nitty-gritty work.
Yeah, so you would offer God as an intentional explanation in terms of something like beliefs and desires or beliefs and pro-attitudes. And, you know, one difficulty there, of course, is depending on what type of theism you endorse, you're going to have different ideas about how much we really can understand God's pro-attitudes. And therefore, if we don't understand God's pro-attitudes, then it's very, I don't see at least how you could be offering an intentional explanation, right?
Well, here we get into the question really of the prior probability. And I think that what you're talking about there to some extent is a question regarding priors rather than a question regarding likelihoods or posteriors. I would not agree with Elliot Sober, for example, that we must have independent evidence of the desires or motives of God in order to conclude that God has done something. And I would say, very simply speaking, we don't have that in the case of our interactions with other human beings. The paper that I've just sent off on history and theism gets into this, and I give there an explanation, and I hope that my friend Madeline won't mind my using her name here because she gave me permission to use it in the paper. But suppose that I wake up one morning and I have absolutely no idea, no reason to believe that a law student named Madeline Flanagan in New Zealand exists. I've never heard of such a person. This is just beyond my ken at that moment. And I certainly have no reason to believe that she wants to make contact with me or anything about her desires at all, one way or the other. I have no evidence on this subject. And then I go and I open my email, and I find an email note purporting to be from Madeline Flanagan saying, would you please send me a copy of this paper that I heard that you wrote or something like that. Now, the point is, I don't have to have independent evidence that this person has this desire to make contact with me. I discovered that this person has this desire to make contact with me by receiving the email. And I would say in the same way, I don't have to have independent reason to believe that God desires to make contact with man or that God desires to raise Jesus from the dead or something like that. That I have, it has to have what we might call a high probability. We might investigate evidence that would be pertinent to it. For example, if Jesus were a charlatan and we had separate evidence that he was out there, you know, cheating little old ladies out of their money or something, you know, okay, that would be a problem for the probability that God would want to raise him from the dead. So whatever independent evidence we have, sure, we throw that in there. But I certainly don't have to have a high probability going into it that God is going to raise Jesus from the dead or that he's going to want to in order to conclude after the fact that that was in fact what he wanted to do. And this is how we interact with people all the time. We discover what their desires and their intentions are by looking at what they do.
Yeah, and one analogy that I enjoy is Bill Craig's story about an alien scrapyard that we discover on the backside of the moon. Certainly we would explain such a scrapyard in terms of intentions and desires of beings whose, you know, motivational makeup we have no knowledge of whatsoever, and yet...
Previously, right.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But the evidence itself would still
It speaks.
Yeah,
the evidence
exactly.
speaks, and we have to let the evidence speak. An example I give in an article that was published in Philo concerning sober, but that was in relation to design argument. I suppose we found a Volkswagen circling, a Volkswagen, Beetle car circling a planet out there somewhere, near Alpha Centauri or something. You know, we would have had no previous reason to believe that there was any alien who had a desire to make a Volkswagen. But there it is, and once it's there, then you have to take it into account. And one of the problems I see with any approach that says, well, we would have to have other knowledge of God's intentions and so forth, is that it would make it impossible to get communication with even an alien race off the ground. In other words, you're not going to have knowledge of their intentions going into the situation anyway. So you have to start somewhere. You always have to start with an initial contact, with that first contact. And in that first contact, you're just going to find out what their capacities are and their intentions and so forth by looking at what it appears that they are doing and what you appear to have discovered, the artifacts or whatever that you appear to have discovered.
Well, Lydia, I must say I've been really enjoying our conversation. Some of the people on my blog insisted that it would be a very heated discussion. I think probably because they see you at least as a socially and politically conservative person, which maybe you are, and I'm extreme leftist and progressive. But what's been really great for me is that we agree so much on methodology and on the points of your epistemology that I don't understand, like the more arcane Bayesian strategies, I at least don't have any reason to disagree with them. And so I feel like, we're on the same page where it matters, and then people like you and I can really have a discussion on the same grounds about where does the evidence point, does it point towards Christian theism?
And I think that's what we have to do. And, I love analytic philosophy, and one of the reasons I love analytic philosophy is because it can be, and in my opinion should be, apolitical and focused on good arguments and good evidence. And
yeah.
I think it would be a sad day when analytic philosophy loses that character. And I hope that never happens, because I've always found that when I've, submitted articles or I've gone to a conference or whatever, we're just doing philosophy. We're doing philosophy because
yeah.
we love philosophy, and that's what it's all about. And that's why, you and I are able to have this good conversation.
Well, Lydia, what is it that you would like to say on any topic, really, to the non-believers who are listening to this podcast?
I would like to say two things. The first thing I want to suggest to any non-believers listening, so many non-believers, and possibly including yourself, are deconverts. They used to be Christians, and now mm-hmm. they're not. Maybe they were raised Christians or whatever. If you or anyone listening deconverted from the very rigid form of Christianity that taught that any discrepancy in the text of Scripture, any contradiction, any trivial error would undermine Christianity, I would like to suggest that you would reconsider. And in the same way, Christianity does not stand or fall based on the age of the earth, for example. First and foremost, Christianity is historical. And historical investigation doesn't work in that tidy, rigid way that some people are most unfortunately taught as Christians, that, this is true, and if this is true, then every tiniest bit of it is true because the Holy Spirit inspired it, and if any part of it is false, then I got to throw it all out the window. That is just not the proper way to approach Christianity, and it's not the proper way to teach young people to be Christians. And I encourage people to realize that there are more robust forms of Christianity that are out there, and to be challenged by that thought. And then the second thing, sort of related, I would want to say is I'd like to suggest doubts concerning skepticism. C.S. Lewis once said in an essay, people who doubt Christianity on the basis of modern textual scholarship should not reduce their doubts. He said, I'm not here to try to make you doubt less. He said, instead, I want to expand your doubts. I want to get you to try to doubt something else. For example, try doubting that the supposed weakness of the historical evidence for Christianity is being explained to you from a perspective of purely objective scholarship. Mm-hmm. Try doubting that physicalism has simply been established by science. It's just a fact. You know, scientists now have told us that the physical is all that there is in the world. Try doubting that and so forth. And then once there are these doubts about skepticism, once people have begun to have doubts about skepticism, follow up. Seek the truth. Christianity has no reason to be afraid of the truth, and Christianity has no reason to be afraid of people who truly seek the truth. And I believe, as a Christian, that God will help those who truly seek the truth and who really want to know the truth, because that's what he wants, too, is for you to know the truth.
Well, Lydia, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks very much. It's been a lot of fun, Luke.
In the next episode, I'll be interviewing philosopher Tyler Wunder about why Alvin Plantinga's reformed epistemology fails. So stay tuned for more Conversations from the Pale Blue Dot.